Bonnie Ray. Here on Radio 4 FM, Abigail Thor reads our book of the week, Elsa Schiaparelli, a biography by Meryl Seacrest. Schiaparelli has survived the war by somehow being permitted to travel between America and France, leading to suspicions of collaboration. Now she's back in Paris, where her business has also survived. It's time to reignite French haute couture.
France was bankrupt and desperately needed exportable goods, and haute couture carried weight both economically and socially. A liberated France needed Schiaparelli. She was home free, but not without being questioned closely by the New York and French authorities about her possible role as a collaborator with the Germans. Unlike some others, she was never charged. In order to get business going again, some sort of common effort was obviously essential. Someone had a bright idea. In the days before photographs, French dressmakers had routinely used porcelain dolls, exquisitely attired, to demonstrate the latest fashions. Why not use dolls to show the world that the vitality of French fashion was as strong as ever and that it was ready for business? The models would show the latest Paris fashions. The dolls were only 2 feet and 3 inches tall, and everything about them had to be reduced to scale. The wigs, hats, gloves, shoes, furs, buttons, safety pins, zips, even handbags and jewellery. Only Paris had the fine skills needed to attempt such a task. The burst of creativity unleashed on the project brought out the best in everyone, from the leather workers who warmed their fingers over candles every few minutes, to the fabric houses who made fabrics that would fold properly on the models. At home, the smart Parisian ladies swept the floor in yards of striped cotton hostess gowns, but at night she emerged in all her plumage, wearing strapless and sleeveless ball gowns with huge skirts made of layered flounces consisting of black tulle petals or in red satin embroidered with ruby beads. She arrived at dinners and balls wearing evening coats of black and silver brocade with black turbans ornamented with netting and feathers. The exhibition that opened in March 1945 at the Louvre was considered so significant that the Garde Républicaine, in full regalia, flanked the staircase on opening night. In a few weeks, the exhibition drew more than 100,000 visitors. The same success followed exhibitions in London, Leeds, Barcelona, Copenhagen, Stockholm, Vienna, and the following spring in New York as well. Schiaparelli was represented by 3 designs. In characteristic fashion, Schiaparelli now began a one-woman campaign to restore her house's former status. Wherever she went, she would be seen and photographed. The Washington Post columnist, Mary Van Rensselaer Thayer, wrote, "Within a week or so of the May-June season in Paris, Schiaparelli made an entree at an assortment of fancy dress balls and a weird variety of costumes, as a popular song, a radish, and a mineral water queen. At a Red Cross charity ball, she appeared with a birdcage tied around her neck containing a live canary. The frightening point was how to start again. How was I to pick up the arrow left lying there and cast it accurately towards the next target?" Schiaparelli wrote. She had not designed anything for 5 years, yet her first autumn collection in September 1945 held no surprises. She continued her own tradition: square shoulders, straight skirts, short jackets, and stiff silks and suits for every moment of the day. Without the guiding tenets of surrealism, Schiaparelli seemed to be floundering. She seemed to lack a unifying rationale for her work, one that was so clear before the war. However, there were flashes of brilliance. There was a strapless black evening dress, cut away in front to reveal part of a pink satin bra, much ornamented. In a flash of her old form, the decorations looked suspiciously like clusters of curling caterpillars. This proved, Newsweek wrote in 1949, that Schiaparelli had reasserted her mastery. However, she had discovered that the London business controlled by Henry Horn was bankrupt, and so was Henry. As for her other ex-lover, Henry's brother Alan, he had sold off his assets and was now living in a tiny house in Grosvenor Square. It cost Schiaparelli some sleepless nights and heavy legal fees to try and buy back control of the business. She was certainly not prepared for the phenomenon that burst upon the world of haute couture in the spring of 1947. Christian Dior was a pink-cheeked man with an air of baby plumpness still about him, Bettina Ballard, fashion editor of Vogue, wrote. When he returned to civilian life after the war, he was hired to design clothes for Lucien Lelong. Then he met Marcel Boussac, a millionaire textile manufacturer. Boussac's deep pockets provided a sumptuous townhouse and paid for advance publicity so that the stage was set that 12th day of February 1947 for the showing of Dior's first collection. There was such demand for seats that some people attempted to get in through the top of the house with ladders. At the end, he received a rapturous ovation. Carmel Snow, editor at Harper's Bazaar, marvelled, "Your dresses have such a new look." Schiaparelli was not going to follow Dior's lead, except to adopt his longer skirts. Haute couture was now in a world of rationing, continued shortages of fuel and materials, and high political unrest. There were constant strikes. At one time, 3 million workers across the country walked out. Schiaparelli was as affected as everyone else. There was a crisis in July 1949 as she was preparing for her winter collection. She wrote, "A winter collection is made during the sweltering heat, so that the sight of furs and woolens makes one faint. And in the old classified buildings in Paris, there is no possibility of installing air conditioning. We sometimes have to carry blocks of ice into the middle of the room." The seamstresses chose that moment to go out on strike. 2 weeks before the opening of her autumn collection, on August the 4th, nothing was ready. Schiaparelli decided they would open anyway. She wrote, "Some coats had no sleeves, others only one. Sketches were pinned to the dresses, pieces of material to the muslin prototypes to show what colours they would eventually be. It was the cheapest collection I ever made, but it sold surprisingly well. And the next day, all the girls were back at work." In 1947, the brilliant and handsome Count Hubert James Marcel Taffin de Jomachy arrived in Paris at the age of 17. Pretty soon, Hubert was an integral part of a peripatetic social life. Schiaparelli began to give him more responsibilities, and he began to introduce logic and order into some of her wasteful buying habits. He was a powerhouse of talent, Bettina Ballard, fashion editor of Vogue, wrote. When, for example, the silhouette began to hang free from the body in what eventually became the chemise line, it was Givenchy who gave it the long, triangular seam cut that made it more than just a sack. Givenchy had planned to stay with Schiaparelli for a year and ended up staying for four. He would periodically say he was leaving and she would keep offering further incentives to stay. When he eventually left in 1951, at the age of 24, she looked at him and said, "You will bankrupt me." But by 1953, someone else had entered her life. Bettina Bergery wrote to Gab de Robillant, Schiaparelli's old friend, that for the past 10 days, Schiaparelli had been in the most radiant humour we have ever seen and looks young. She was then 63. Pink, healthy, neat and pretty. If it's love or quite a big check, no one knows. I do hope it's a combination. It was certainly love. He was John Gallier, a slim, black-haired American. He had the ability to look at people with his penetrating blue eyes and make them think that he or she was the most important person in the world. He was one of the few people who was Schiaparelli's equal in intellect and different enough in temperament to coax her out of a bad mood or penetrate her icy silences with an irresistible quip. But in 1954, he went back to New York and she stayed on in Paris. Now there was a granddaughter. Gogo had married her American husband in New York, choosing a moment when Schiaparelli was on another continent. Their daughter, Marissa Berenson, was born in February 1947. There is a charming photograph of the baby lying on a fur-lined chaise longue wearing a flowing white christening dress. Her smiling mother kneels on the left, and her equally delighted father stands in the background. Her grandmother kneels on the right. She is looking, not as one might expect, at the baby or even at the photographer, but somewhere out of the frame, with a grave expression. The post-war years saw extravagant displays of wealth, and one of Schiaparelli's parties of that period took place because she had not managed to get a date from the Chambre Syndicale de la Couture for the showing of her winter collection. So she decided to do it at home instead, in her spacious garden at midnight. Platforms and tents were set up, catwalks built, chairs and tables imported, and the finishing touch was vast numbers of pink tartan hangings. The affair was a great success, and she continued working ceaselessly to re-establish her reputation. But her post-war designs too often show a falling off of concentration, a kind of ennui. The couture business was losing money. Schiaparelli told the New York Times, "Life has changed for elegant women. Even people with money aren't spending the way they used to. Today, only a feeble minority of women will pay the prices we are forced to ask." Perhaps she had been too sure of herself as a dictator of fashion to realize that the ground had shifted under her feet. Her debts mounted. Banks refused to lend her any more money. The collection she presented on February the 3rd, 1954, was her last. In a series of articles written for the Star newspaper in 1953, the year before she went bankrupt, Schiaparelli's tone was melancholic. Fame gave her no comfort. "I do not believe for a moment that women who make tremendous successes of their lives are happy. Fame, for a woman, is invariably built on unhappiness and disappointment." In March 1954, Bettina Bergeri wrote, "Elsa came to dinner in a sad state. She looked as if she had hardly bothered to comb her hair, and there was a hole in her stocking. She fell asleep during the dinner and then came out staggering to leave." She talked about bank managers who had supported her for years, refusing to lend her any more money, and disastrous sales. The staff left, and the house of Schiaparelli was no more. Elsa could afford to stay on in her home at 22 Rue de Berry, thanks to the perfume business and licenses. And there was the consolation of Hammamet on the Tunisian coast, an unpretentious fishing village where she had bought a small but charming beach house in 1950. Schiaparelli went there as often as she could and revelled in the solitude. For her, the house at Hammamet was the last port before the next world. And the maxim that prefaces her memoir, written in the 1950s, was the ancient Chinese belief: birth is not the beginning, death is not the end.
Abigail Thor was reading from Elsa Schiaparelli, a biography by Meryl Seacrest. It was abridged by Libby Spurrier, produced by Joanna Green, and was a peer production for BBC Radio 4. Beginning on Monday and throughout the week at 9:45, Peter Hennessy will be looking at how further devolution will change the United Kingdom's constitution. The Rise and Fall of the Yorkshire Symphony Orchestra, 1947 to 1955.
As a Yorkshire lad, I suppose it was more famous to me than the New York Philharmonic, which I later became leader of.
A first-class orchestra, remembered by its musicians and fans, including Alan Bennett.
The Victoria Hall, where the concerts were held, was situated over the Civic Restaurant. So if I'm taken unaware by the smell of fish and chips nowadays, it brings back those concerts in the 1940s.
Death of an Orchestra, on Tuesday morning at 11:30, and then on the BBC Radio 4 website.